Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect, it is 1:33 p.m. on Tuesday, March 29th, 2022. Present today, Representative Thompson, Representative Lavon, Vice Chair Ortiz, online co-chair Foster, Representative Josephson, Representative Wohl, Representative Johnson, and myself, co-chair Merrick. And in the room with us today, it looks like we have Senator Stevens, and I believe I saw Representative Rauscher. That's all I see in the room. Hi there. Welcome. This afternoon, we will take public testimony and consider amendments to Senate Bill 33, Seafood Product Development Tax Credit, and hear introductions of three pieces of legislation as time allows. House Bill 265, Telehealth, House Bill 296, Donations for DOT Signage, and House Bill 291, Extending the Domestic Violence Council. So first up, we have Senator Stevens back with Senate Bill 33, Seafood Product Development Tax Credit, and we heard this bill on March 9th, and amendments were due to my office by the 14th. Senator, welcome back. Do you have any comments before we go to invited testimony?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate your hearing this bill again. Senator Gary Stevens from Kodiak Senate District P. So this bill I know it's a little complex. I keep thinking it's simple, but it's not. But it's a value-added bill that allows seafood seafood processors to use a tax rebate in order to buy new equipment to establish new processes. And it's worked well in the past. We've done it with salmon starting in 2003. But that program came to an end because we didn't extend it at the end of 2020. So it was expired and was repealed. So this bill restores that salmon and herring tax credit, but it also adds pollock, Pacific cod, and sablefish products as well. This is for a reimbursement for investments in equipment and hardware, machinery, infrastructure, and is really truly a value-added issue for our seafood processors. It's worked well in the past. I know it'll work well in the future, and appreciate your hearing the bill.
Great. Thank you very much. And we will move to invited testimony. First, we have Mark Palmer, CEO of Ocean Beauty Seafoods. Mr. Palmer, welcome. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony. And let the record reflect, at 1:35 p.m., we're joined by Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Palmer. I'm the President and CEO of OBI Seafoods. OBI Seafoods operates 10 production facilities across the state of Alaska. I would like to point out a couple of things that I think are very significant about the benefits of the value-added tax credit. One of the things that we've really experienced over the past 3 or 4 years is a change in some of our markets. The erosion of the Chinese market because of hostile trade policies towards the United States has dramatically impacted how much of our raw material we export into that market. That was the largest seafood market, destination market for products from Alaska for the last 9-10 years. And as that's changed, what's happened is we've become more reliant on the domestic U.S. market and the EU market. Both of these markets have premium segments to them, and they have consumers that will consume higher value, once frozen, value-added products produced in Alaska. And so it's important that we have the ability to produce those products in the state and target these higher value markets as we try and get away from exporting more of our products into China. About a month ago, the world changed substantially. With Russia's product not being able to be imported into the United States now, any deal that was not completed with the Russians before the 11th of March, their product can no longer come to the U.S. And we were just at the Boston Seafood Show as an industry a couple of weeks ago. There's very radical realignment right now of supply chains, and there's going to be an opportunity for Alaska companies to replace Russian seafood in many of the markets here, domestic and in Europe. So what the credit does is it's created new infrastructure. If we use this, as Senator Stevens alluded to, since 2003 to put new equipment into many of our plants as well as many other seafood companies around the state. And in a lot of those cases, the equipment that we used the tax credit on was the lower component of the project cost. I could give you an example of our meal and oil plant that we put in Cordova. I think we claimed somewhere around $800,000 on the tax credit, yet the total value of that project was over $4.5 million of the component that we put in. So the building, the foundation, the electricity, all of the plumbing, all of the things that we hired local contractors for, the investments that we made in Cordova, all of that was done on our money, not utilizing the tax credit. So when we do go put new equipment in the plants, we have to put a lot of investment around that, and that investment benefits the local communities. It benefits the fishermen that we work with, increasing the value of their catch. And it's, as Senator Stevens said, it's a proven track record. It's worked, and that's why we believe that this should be supported. And I thank you for your opportunity to allow me to testify today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. We appreciate you calling in today. Please let the record reflect at 1:36 p.m. we were joined by Representative Edgman. Our next testifier is Abby Fredericks, the Executive Administrator at Silver Bay Seafoods. Ms. Fredericks, welcome to House Finance. Could you please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Abby Frederick. I am representing Silver Bay Seafoods. I'm from Juneau, Alaska, and I appreciate you providing some time for me to offer some testimony. I realize that there is quite a few things going on for you guys lately, and I do not have anything additional to add beyond my testimony on record for this bill, as well as our letter of support for this bill. And so I just wanted to go ahead and let you know that. Appreciate the time today, though.
Thank you, Ms. Frederick. We appreciate you calling in and sharing your support. I do not see any questions from the committee, so with that, we will move to public testimony. I'm opening public testimony on Senate Bill 33. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify on Senate Bill 33? Is there anyone online wishing to testify? Seeing and hearing none, I will close public testimony. With that, we will move to amendments, and we'll take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. We have amendments before the committee. Amendment number one by Representative Wolf. Representative Wolf.
I move amendment number one.
Object for discussion. Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Amendment number one.
Can you please talk into your mic?
Oh, yeah, good idea.
Thank you very much.
I forget about that sometimes. Amendment number one is sort of a backstop type amendment. Basically, if in the bill, starting on page 3 at the bottom, section 1, it talks about recapture percentage. And if you buy equipment that you're going to get a tax credit for, you get various percentages of tax credits. And after 4 years, you get the full 50% tax credit for the equipment that you bought. And what this says is that if a company buys some equipment and gets the tax credit, they keep it for 4 years, they get the full tax credit that's coming to them. It says if they want to buy a new, replace that equipment and buy a new one, they have to wait 10 years. In other words, this would prevent, and I'm not saying this happens, but some of these companies have locations in other states. They could buy equipment up here, get the tax credit after 4 years, ship it out and buy a new one and repeat that process. So this just says if you're buying a piece of equipment that you're getting a tax credit for, you get the full refund after 4 years, but you have to keep it. You can't buy a new replacement piece of equipment until 10 years. So I didn't, just a little backstop. And I do have a conceptual amendment to this amendment that we discussed with the bill sponsor, and when you're ready, it's just a couple words in the amendment, but I'll introduce that now if you like.
Yes, Representative Wolf.
Okay, introduce conceptual amendment number one to amendment number one.
Object for discussion.
Thank you. On line 14, and continuing on to line 15, it says, for property that is the same type of property as, comma, or that is comparable. I'm going to eliminate that as comparable and just make it for the same type of property. So it basically says if you buy the same type of equipment, you can't keep buying the same type of equipment and getting a tax credit every 4 years. You'd have to wait 10 years. So I would delete starting with the word as on line 14 and continuing to the entirety of line 15.
And I'm sorry, what page?
It's page 1 of the amendment.
Lines 14 and 15? Brief it is. Thank you. House Finance back on the record. Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Amendment number one, N.6, page one of amendment one, starting on line 14, it reads, for property that is the same type of property, the word as, which follows the second property, all the way to the end of the sentence, I want to delete, so it doesn't say, or that is comparable. I just want to say for property, this is the same type of property.
Are there questions? Hearing none, I remove my objection to the conceptual amendment, which takes us to amendment one as amended. Are there questions? Hearing none, Representative Wolf. Pardon me, Representative Laban.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And for the maker of the amendment, just to be clear, if after 4 years I want to ship a piece of equipment out of state and replace it, I could do that, but I would just not be entitled to the credit.
Through the chair, that is correct. You can buy as much equipment as you like, but if you want to get the tax credit, and you can only get that every 10 years for the same type of equipment. Now you can buy if you don't replace the equipment, you buy additional equipment. Let's say I buy an ice machine, my business grows, I buy another ice machine, and I still have the original one, you still get the tax credit. It's if you, after 4 years, you ship it out and then replace it, you can't do that.
Yep. Follow up then.
Follow up?
Not to split hairs, but if I upgrade, technology improves, I can get a better ice machine. So I remove the other one and I want to replace it with a better model, a new and improved ice machine. Am I out of luck?
Well, if it's the same type of property, then you're out of luck. If it's different enough, if you want to just add to your one, you want to replace it. You want to replace it after 4 years, do a bigger and better one. You know, I guess that's at the discretion of the regulators.
Yeah. So I guess, Madam Chair, thank you. As follow-up, I guess I'm just trying to not discourage upgrades in equipment. That the technology changes rapidly, and I would hate to discourage upgrades.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I feel the same way, Representative LeBon. And I think an upgrade in technology would not be the same type of equipment. It would be an improved type of equipment. So I think it wouldn't it would still qualify for the tax credit. You know, it's a new type of machine, and that's why we said same type. And then if it's not the same type, it would still be eligible.
Great, thank you. Further questions on Amendment 1 as amended? Seeing none, I will remove my objection. Is there a further objection? Seeing none, Amendment 1 as amended has passed. Amendment number 2 by Representative Ortiz will not be offered, which takes us to Amendment number 3. Representative Ortiz.
Madam Chair, I move Amendment number 3.
Object for discussion, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to invite Senator Stephen's staff, Tim Lampkin, to come up and speak to this amendment. Thank
Mr.
you.
Lampkin. Or Senator Stephens, please go ahead.
Thank you. For the record, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stephens. Just want to confirm that amendment number 2 before us is labeled at the top right corner as NNovember.9, correct?
Correct, and this is listed for us as amendment number 3.
Yes.
Excuse me, number 3, N.9. Thank you.
Correct.
So this amendment number three is addressing a concern of potential perceived hypothetical loophole that a value-added tax credit could be applied to processing activities in the fisheries of pollock, cod, and sablefish aboard vessels outside of state waters, but yet not landed inside state waters. The amendment is specifically to carve out the new fisheries that we're addressing of cod, pollock, and sablefish, such that it holds harmless the existing salmon and herring credits that have been on the books for 15 plus years, and in this instance would require that in order for processors of those new fisheries in pollock, cod, and sablefish to be qualified for the credit, that the investments have to occur on onshore processing facilities.
Thank you for that clarification. Are there questions regarding amendment number 3? Hearing none, I remove my objection. Are there further questions on the bill itself? Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, for Mr. Lampkin or Senator Stevens, my understanding is that the tax in question brings in about $50 million a year. I see that there's a Q&A document that reflects that the credit helped generate an additional $114 million over some period of time. I guess my first question is, am I right that it's about $50 million? And I'll start with that.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Senator Stevens. I think we have a tax person online, do we not, Tim? And that'd be the best person to get that answer from, Representative.
Thank you. It looks like Nicole Reynolds, Deputy Director, Tax Division, Department of Revenue, is online. Ms. Reynolds, could you place yourself on the record and help Representative Josephson with this question?
Good afternoon. Through the co-chair, my name is Nicole Reynolds. I'm the Deputy Director of the Tax Division. Representative Josephson, the tax collections for the fisheries business tax over the past 4 fiscal years range between $34.6 million and $46.2 million.
All right.
Representative Josephson.
And I guess for any of the three, Ms. Reynolds or our colleagues here, historically the credit was in the low millions of dollars. And do we know, is it just sort of guesswork in terms of what this reform would do to the growth of the credit and its impact on the tax?
Oh, thank you. Senator Stevens here. I think Ms. Reynolds can answer that question for us.
Thank you, Ms. Reynolds.
Thank you. Through the co-chair, Nicole Reynolds, for the record, the historic value of this credit between 2017 and 2020 ranged between $2.3 million and $4.4 million. The department, we did submit a fiscal note for this bill, and we had to do a little bit of guesswork in terms of estimating a revenue impact, but we took the historical value and utilization rates of the salmon and herring credit to estimate how the revenue would be impacted by adding Pacific cod, sablefish, and pollock. And for fiscal year 2023, we estimated a negative $1.6 million for the credit. And then between fiscal year 2024 through 2027, we estimated between $3 million and $3.6 million annually for the credit.
Representative Josephson.
Yes, and then follow up, Ms. Reynolds, and then we could, by producing hopefully something sustainable that is value added, we could be increasing the tax itself. Is that possible?
Through the co-chair, the tax is applied to the fisheries resources that are processed in state waters. It's possible that that the tax revenue, well, let me back up. So the tax is on the value of the raw resource. So the tax isn't applied to the resource once it has already been processed.
So it sort of is what it is, as they say today.
Right. We wouldn't expect the tax revenue to increase because of the credit.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just want to make sure I understand and people listening understand. You said between 40 and 50 million was the total landing tax, is that correct? Or business tax, fish business tax?
Ms. Reynolds?
Thank you. Nicole Reynolds for the chair, co-chair, or through the chair. The fisheries business tax revenue ranged between 34.6 million and 46.2 million over the last four fiscal years.
Representative Wolf.
Hello. Thank you. So, but the half of that goes to the municipalities and the state retains the other half, and then the credit we're talking about only applies to the state half. Is that correct? So 34 to 46 would be 17 to 23 into the state coffers.
Through the co-chair, Nicole Reynolds for the record, that's correct. So the half of the fish business tax is shared with the municipality, and then the credit is taken out of the state's share of the revenue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further regarding Senate Bill 33? Seeing none, Mr. Vice Chair.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 33, version 32-LS0308/N from committee as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, and authorize legislative legal services to make conform. conforming changes.
Is there an objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill 33 is moved from committee. Thank you, Senator Stevens and Mr. Lampkin, for presenting for us today. And
with
that, we'll take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. Next, we have House Bill 265, Healthcare Services by Telehealth, by Representative Swanholtz. She is on Teams with us today. Hello, Representative. You and your staff, Genevieve Mina, I believe, is here. She would like to come to the table. If you could place yourself on the record, and you can begin your presentation. Representative Swanholtz.
All right, thank you. For the record, I'm Representative Ivy Swanholtz. I represent House District 16. I will introduce the bill via a PowerPoint presentation. Ms. Mina will advance the slides, and then we'll do a sectional analysis of the committee has time. I know that you've got a busy schedule this afternoon. All right. So thanks so much for hearing House Bill 265, which expands telehealth flexibilities that made healthcare more accessible and reduce unnecessary travel during the COVID-19 pandemic. Essentially, House Bill 265 is designed to create a legislative framework to continue the state of Alaska's success with COVID-19 related telehealth flexibilities with regard to state and federal oversight. Our intention is that this legislation will remove specific barriers to telehealth and allow the state and respective licensing boards to adopt regulations that ensure delivery of telehealth makes sense for the scope of their practice and for patient care. The slide in the photo shows the old model, and the previous slide shows the old model of telehealth care, where you had to go to an inpatient clinic, you had to do it via video, and you had to have a provider on site with you. What we now know during as a result of our time during COVID is that much of that is not necessary to ensure safe and accessible care in the state of Alaska. We do also have available for questions Sarah Chambers, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing, Renee Gayhart with Medicaid, and Jennifer Moreau Johnson, Director of the Division of Behavioral Health Services. And on to slide two, House Bill 265 will maintain and expand Alaska's access to telehealth services, which was broadened during COVID-19. This presentation today is going to essentially cover telehealth in Alaska, what we made possible via COVID-19, why House Bill 265 is needed, and then what this bill specifically does. We've worked with a broad group of stakeholders on this bill, and that's why we have over 33 letters of formal support for this. And thank you also to members Rasmussen and Ortiz for co-sponsoring this bill. On slide three, you'll see that essentially there are barriers to telehealth in the state of Alaska that focus in licensing regulation and payment barriers to telehealth. The legislature's been working for years to expand access to telehealth. In Senate Bill 74 in 2016, we expanded behavioral health care, Medicaid access to behavioral health care. And then in 2020, we passed House Bill 229 requiring insurance coverage in the private market for telehealth. However, even with those bills, there continue to be payment and regulatory barriers to telehealth in the state of Alaska. One is that there isn't telehealth payment parity in Alaska. As a result, telehealth is often paid at a lower rate than is in-person visit. As a result, there's a financial disincentive on the part of providers to provide services via telehealth. Some Medicaid-eligible services are currently prohibited from reimbursement if they're delivered via telehealth, including home and community-based services, which includes things like care coordination, which has been successfully delivered via telehealth over the last couple of years. There are in-person examinations and documentation barriers for access to telehealth that are unnecessary, and these create barriers to medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder and other treatments for things like ADHD. There are also barriers to audio-only visits, which have proven incredible in providing access to health care in rural Alaska over the last couple of years. And moving on to slide four, COVID-19 changed a lot of things for telehealth in the state of Alaska. There was a state public health emergency, which gave us a lot of flexibility, a federal public health emergency, which gave us a lot of flexibility. The state public health emergency expired last year, and the federal public health emergency is slated to expire on April 16th, making passage of House Bill 265 urgent in many respects. Also, currently Medicaid has temporarily expanded access to telehealth coverage for other services and made it easier to bill for audio only, but these changes are not permanent, and we wish to make many of those changes permanent. So moving on to slide five, why do we need House Bill 265? I mean, I think I've described many of the reasons that telehealth is important, but essentially we want to continue some of the telehealth flexibilities that have been accessible to us via our experience in COVID-19 over the last couple of years. We want to reduce barriers and red tape to access the healthcare via telehealth. We want to expand Medicaid coverage for telehealth services that have been reimbursed during the pandemic. We want to increase access to behavioral health care, including, very importantly, medication-assisted treatment, and ensure that Alaskans don't have unnecessary travel requirements for health care in the state of Alaska. So moving on to slide six, you'll see that House Bill 265 is designed to create a framework for telehealth in Alaska, starting with the presumption that telehealth should be allowed, enhances treatment for behavioral health and substance abuse disorder treatment via telehealth, and expands Medicaid coverage for telehealth services. So moving on to slide seven, starting at the beginning, you'll see there's a laundry list of providers that provide care in Alaska via telehealth, or may be able to provide telehealth care in Alaska. House Bill 265 removes unnecessary barriers to telehealth by eliminating in-person requirements and efforts to document efforts to visit via telehealth, or to visit in person prior to a telehealth. And some of these don't seem intuitively obvious to those of us that don't practice healthcare. But, you know, if your back goes out, you need to do a telehealth consultation with your chiropractor. You need to know whether or not you need to go in person for an examination, or if you need to go to the emergency room for something more serious. If you want to see a podiatrist for telehealth, it seems like that might be extraneous, but we actually talked to Dr. Halala, who is recently up for confirmation to the state medical board, who's a podiatrist who actually diagnosed a blood clot via telehealth using, you know, somebody's telephone to look at their leg. So we want to remove barriers to requirements and allow those allow providers to determine whether or not it's clinically appropriate. Very importantly, nothing about 265 requires either that the patient receive healthcare via telehealth or that the provider deliver the health care via telehealth. And that's really important because if you have a patient that is, exhibiting, symptoms of opioid use disorder that appears to be uncontrolled, you want the provider to be able to call them into their office for an in-person examination. You want them also to say, I don't think that I have enough information based on the telehealth appointment that we're having today to, to diagnose you. But you do want to remove barriers, unnecessary red tape barriers to access to that care. It also extends those flexibilities to emergency medical services for many of the same reasons that sometimes the only provider you'd be able to have access to in an urgent situation would be an emergency provider. And then entities that provide that are covered under Title 47, which provide community mental health services and substance use disorder treatment, are included as well. Moving on to slide 8.
Pardon, Representative Sponholz, there's a question from Representative LeBon.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative, for your presentation. My question is on the list of providers, and I'm just trying to visualize dental services via telehealth. So I need my annual cleaning and checkup. How do I do that via telehealth?
Yeah, that's a great question, Representative LeBon, through the chair. You wouldn't provide an annual checkup and examination via telehealth, but you would potentially, allow for an emergency examination to take place via telehealth where you could, have the video up close to your mouth and determine whether or not you need to go urgently into the dentist's office or whether you can stay home, whether it's because you're in rural Alaska and you don't have access to an airplane right away, or you need to determine whether or not it's an urgent situation, or whether or not you've got a young kid at home and you just don't have childcare. We want to allow the regulating boards to make those determinations and not have legislators be in charge of determining when it's clinically appropriate.
Representative LeBon.
Okay, so I guess it's the first step of a dental experience would be maybe telehealth, but eventually you probably have to go to see the dentist. But thank you for that answer. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I just wanted to highlight on the record that the list I think provided here gives flexibility and options if you're experiencing a tooth pain, for example. My daughter late last year had a really bad stomach bug, both of my kids did, and I was able to use telehealth to call and speak with a physician who said, look out for these symptoms, and when it got to the point that she wasn't producing tears, I knew because of my telehealth visit that I needed to take her to the ER, and she was admitted to get fluids and everything. I think it's kind of a similar thing with different areas here where if you have tooth pain, I mean, this isn't going to take place of your annual appointment, but maybe they say, try to deep floss or do something, and maybe that will eliminate your tooth pain and avoid going in. But I think annual in-person visits are still going to be necessary and not prohibited in this bill.
Thank you. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I had a second question, and it's not dental related. So back on slide 5, there's one of the boxes talks about eliminating in-person visits for all healthcare providers licensed with the state of Alaska prior to a telehealth appointment. So is it conceivable that an out-of-state provider could be licensed to provide telehealth services for an Alaska resident from, say, Seattle or some other location out of state? And would that provider be required to have a personal visit before providing telehealth services? Or I guess there's two questions in there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Sponholz.
Representative LeBon, through the chair, that's a great question. In the state of Alaska, you are required, if you're going to provide care in the state of Alaska, you're required to be licensed in the state of Alaska, whether or not you reside in the state. And there are already many providers who reside somewhere else but who are licensed in the state of Alaska and are eligible to provide care via telehealth, and they are registered via, they get approved, their licenses get approved by the relevant licensing board, and they register via the telemedicine registry with the division, I think it's with the Division of Insurance, and So this is already happening, and essentially what we're saying is that you shouldn't have to have an in-person examination or document reasons why you couldn't have a telehealth appointment prior to getting that care if the provider deems that it's clinically appropriate. And I think, you know, an example, your example of the dental examination is a great example where that's definitely not clinically appropriate, but there are times when a telehealth appointment could be very appropriate without having an in-person examination. And examples that are used fairly frequently that we've heard about include, consulting oncologists outside of the state of Alaska who may have a special expertise in the kind of cancer that you're undergoing, where your in-state oncologist may refer you to an out-of-state oncologist at, say, like Seattle Cancer Care, and suggest that you have an appointment with them. We think you shouldn't have to fly out of state in order to have that appointment. You should be able to do that via telehealth.
And as a follow-up, Madam Chair, then just to be clear, then that out-of-state provider would not have had to have a prior face-to-face examination or meeting with the patient, whether it's referred to by an Alaska doctor or not, that would not be required as long as the out-of-state provider is licensed to do medicine in Alaska.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Representative Spunholtz, with the provider under this, if they are out of state, and I understand you've changed this to an in-state focus, but to the extent this expands telemedicine out of state, would they be licensed in two states? So they'd be licensed in Alaska and in another state?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, they could choose to be licensed only in the state of Alaska, or they could choose to be licensed in their home state and in the state of Alaska. In licensing enforcement in the United States, licensing follows the state of residence of the patient and not the state of residence of the provider. So you could hypothetically have somebody who had practiced in Alaska for 25 years and then retired to Seattle, and they could continue, if they maintained their Alaska license in good standing, continue to practice in the state of Alaska without a license in Washington.
Yes, follow up.
And what about international licensure? Would this welcome providers from another country as long as they were licensed here?
I'm going to have to defer that question to Director Sarah Chambers.
Ms. Chambers, if you could place yourself on the record. Oh, you're here. Wonderful.
Hiding behind the TV screen. Thank you, Chair Merrick, members of the committee. For the record, Sarah Chambers. I'm the Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. And as I understand the question through the Chair, Representative Josephson, you asked about whether someone who held a license in someplace outside of the United States could practice with an Alaska license. If they met the criteria for an Alaska license, they could certainly apply and do currently apply. And so that would, if they were fully licensed in Alaska, they could physically be anywhere and perform telehealth regardless of where they happen to hold another license.
Thank you.
Thank you. I see no further questions. Representative Spunholtz, please continue.
All right, thank you. So moving back to slide 8, HB 265 intends to enhance telehealth access, not only for substance use disorder treatment as is described in the slide, but also for other kinds of behavioral health care. This is pretty important. In the state of Alaska, it removes in-person requirements to prescribe certain controlled substances. This is important because some of those controlled substances include Adderall, which is used to treat ADHD, and buprenorphine, which is used to provide care for medication-assisted treatment. We heard very clearly from physicians that it's really important that they be able to prescribe those kinds of medications in a very quick fashion when people are going through opioid use disorder withdrawals. We aligned in-house HESS, we aligned the Board of Nursing prescribing statutes in the bill to reflect their current prescribing authority, which is in line with physicians in the state of Alaska already. It's important to note that all prescribers of controlled substances are still required by this bill to comply with the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency regulations and also with the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, which this committee is well familiar with. And moving on to slide nine.
Representative Sponholz, there's a question from Representative Josephson.
Yes, through the chair, does the definition of controlled substances include narcotics and opiates?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, it does include those things, and I think that that's important to do in this because there are times when an opioid may be prescribed via telehealth in an urgent scenario. Somebody may be in a rural community. You want them to be able to get the access to the prescription to that opioid in a prompt fashion without having to do an additional in-person examination.
Follow-up?
So we know, Reverend Sponholz, that there will be efforts, and they could come in either direction, that is from the provider or the patient, to abuse this privilege. What are the protections built into this so that the committee can feel confident that there won't be an abuse of the prescriptions?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and it's likely that there would be people that would seek to try to abuse this, and that's why it's very important that providers continue to have to participate in the Drug Enforcement Agency and the PDMP in order to ensure that there isn't manipulation of the system. There are ways that providers can ensure that drug-seeking behavior isn't being advanced. There are innovations, right? There's been a lot of innovations recently in terms of treatment, and there's nothing requiring a provider prescribe medications to a drug-seeking patient, and that's a really important thing that we've worked on. Genevieve Mina, and there in the room, may also have some additional comments she'd like to add.
Ms. Mina?
Yes, thank you for the question. For the record, this is Genevieve Mina, staff to Representative Ivy Sponholz. So thank you for the question, Representative Josephson. In relation to restrictions on opioid misuse, for medication-assisted treatment, by federal law, it requires that you must have behavioral health treatment as part of any medications for opioid use disorder. So in this bill, this would be pertaining to buprenorphine, which was a medication that was allowed throughout the COVID-19 pandemic to be prescribed and delivered via telehealth. Additionally, for providers who are registered to prescribe buprenorphine, there's physical monitoring tools that are best practice to ensure that there isn't misuse of the medication that is part of their opioid plan. That physical monitoring tool can include urine tests that can be requested in a laboratory on a regular basis. Additionally, there's restrictions in the state, such as the 7-day prescription for opioids, where there has to be a prescription on a weekly basis, as well as what Representative Sponholz referred to with the PDMP and DEA enforcement and regulations.
Representative Josephson.
My only comment, I understand the importance of the bill, and I'm likely to support the bill, and I appreciate it being offered. But we spend a couple hours talking about the PDMP, and we know that it's not being followed religiously. And I just remember the Eagle River provider, a PA who I actually knew a little bit, who would have these quick interactions with her patients and then just prescribe more and more medication. And I don't know. I worry about the prescriptions getting out of hand and would feel more comfortable. Well, let me ask this. Representative Sponholz, must the provider in this circumstance physically look at their patient on the screen, or could this be limited to just a phone call?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency requires, I believe, that it for medication-assisted treatment. Actually, I'm going to defer this question to Ms. Mina. I've got COVID brain here.
Ms. Mina? Thank you. Thank you for the question, Representative Josephson. Through the chair, prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, the DEA does require that a patient who receives medications for opioid use disorder must receive an in-person examination. This provision was waived during the COVID-19 pandemic that is tied to the federal public health emergency, which is set to expire in April. Additionally, the DEA also allowed audio-only prescription of buprenorphine. And so prior to COVID-19, you did have to require to have an in-person examination. However, in conversations that we've had with Suboxone providers and other MAT providers, that for most individuals, examinations are a crucial part of their treatment. And if an in-person examination is removed prior to the prescription of buprenorphine, that doesn't mean that provider can't see that patient for an in-person examination. And so what this bill does is that it defers to the patient-provider relationship so that the provider makes that decision rather than always requiring an in-person examination in all cases. And when we've seen the access to opioid use treatment during the COVID-19 pandemic, that's been crucial in places like rural Alaska, where access for opioid use disorder treatment via telehealth is the difference between care and no care.
Representative Josephson.
Again, I think there's all sorts of net positives here, but the two circumstances I'm going to say was the summer of 2019 were egregious. And I read the DEA transcripts. I think they were on a link to the Daily News. One was a provider from Soldotna, the other this PA from Eagle River. And I just worry that there's going to be some bad actors. There just absolutely are going to be. And
Representative Josephson, you're absolutely correct that there were bad actors, and nothing in this bill would prevent that from happening. But what we do have in place are robust both prescription drug limits and also enforcement mechanisms and in licensing in order to take away people's licenses. And I think it's one of the reasons that it's really important that we have a very robust prescription drug monitoring program. However, it is very important to note that buprenorphine, which is a very important medication-assisted treatment program, medication, which is a Schedule III controlled substance, is something that would be able to be prescribed via telehealth. And there are times when people will have to be on medication-assisted treatment for years on end. Many of them will work in remote work camps. They will work on fishing boats. They will work in the mining industry. They will work in the oil industry. And they will not always have access to an in-person examination, but they will sometimes need renewal of their prescriptions along the way. And we want to make sure that we continue to have access to that very important medication-assisted treatment moving forward.
Thank you. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I have a question, but I also just want to follow up on what Representative Sponholt said, which was I do believe there we can't eliminate all bad actors. And I would imagine if you're seeing a physician for the first time and your first visit is telehealth and you're complaining of something that and requesting opioids, I would imagine that would be a major red flag for any physician. I've seen physicians that I know and seen for years, and they're very hesitant to prescribe anything like that. So I would imagine this isn't for first-time patients for opioid prescriptions on telehealth, and I don't know if Representative Sponholz wants to comment on that, but I guess my quick question was, it says DEA registered practitioners, physicians, PAs, and I know this bill doesn't have anything to do with veterinarians, but they are DEA registered practitioners. So just to get this off the table, this doesn't apply to veterinarians for animal prescriptions. And can I assume that's correct?
It is. Veterinarians are not included in this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative.
And I would like to, if I may, Madam Couture, address the issue of first-time patients. It is actually possible that you could have a first-time patient getting access to medication-assisted treatment via telehealth, and this was identified for us by the emergency room physicians. They sometimes see people who are going through substance use order withdrawal, and they need to make sure that their patients get access to medication-assisted treatment immediately so that they can then be supported as they try to get into inpatient, residential treatment or something like that. And they said very explicitly that they thought that it was important that people be able to have access to medication-assisted treatment via telehealth for that reason, because there is a time sensitivity. And sometimes if you miss that recovery window, people will move on from their recovery moment.
Thank you, Representative Sponholz. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and I guess my question is, for other first-time issues, I could see, an urgent care provider that can even hear that somebody has a severe cold and a horrible cough and, prescribe them cough syrup with codeine, for example, over the phone without needing to see that person on video. But have any other instances for first-time visits been identified? Because it seems like you would have areas where, like in urgent care, you may see cough syrup or you may see certain narcotics through a surgeon or something post-surgery, which wouldn't be a first-time visit. So I was just curious if there's any other instances of that that you guys have been made aware of through the process.
I think those are the kinds of examples that we've discussed today and that you just mentioned are the kinds of primary examples for a first-time prescription of a controlled substance. You might also, of course, have an issue of Adderall, which is also a controlled substance. It's a Schedule II controlled substance, and you could have somebody that could have a very appropriate, complete examination of a patient via telehealth. A psychiatrist could do that and know absolutely for sure that this patient was not drug-seeking and that Adderall was an appropriate medication for them, and we wouldn't want to unnecessarily require that person to come into town for an in-person physical examination.
Thank you, and I will ask Representative Sponholz to continue and complete her presentation, and then we will go to the two invited testifiers. And then we will move on. We have two other bills to be introduced today. Representative Sponholz.
All right, thank you. So continuing on with slide three, House Bill 265.
I believe we're on slide nine, Representative. It's probably
I'm sorry, slide nine, yep. COVID brain. Slide nine, expanding Medicaid coverage for telehealth. House Bill 265 allows for reimbursement of services that are already billable by Medicaid if they're in person, but not necessarily via telehealth, including, as I mentioned earlier, home and community-based services, which include care coordination, which we heard from AARP was a very important element of care moving forward, and ensures payment parity for telehealth modalities, including audio-only visits. That's really important because we want to financially incentivize the provision of care via telehealth and not disincentivize it. And this section of the bill also makes it easier for providers in rural and who provide care in rural settings to provide care via telephone, which has been just a godsend for rural Alaskan patients and providers. So moving on to slide 10. House Bill 265 is designed to make permanent some of the flexibilities that we've enjoyed during the COVID-19 public health emergencies that we've experienced while still ensuring robust patient protection in the state of Alaska and high-quality patient care. And that's we've been thankful to be working with a really diverse group of healthcare stakeholders, including the 32-plus organizations who've written formal letters of support for the bill. We could not have done it without them. I also want to thank the Department of Commerce, Community, Economic, and Development and the Department of Health and Social Services for their work. And thanks so much for hearing House Bill 265. And if you'd like, Ms. Mita is available to do a sectional analysis.
Actually, we'll forego that today as we're running short on time, but I would like to get to our two invited testifiers as they have been waiting online. It looks like first we have Nancy Merriman, Executive Director of the Alaska Primary Care Association. Welcome, Ms. Merriman. If you could state your name, affiliation, and please proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chairs Merrick and Foster and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nancy Merriman, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Primary Care Association. And I'm pleased to join you today in support of HB 265. The Alaska Primary Care Association, or APCA, supports the operations and the development of Alaska's 29 federally qualified health centers, also known as FQHCs or community health centers. Health centers provide comprehensive whole person care, which includes medical, dental, behavioral, pharmacy, and care coordination services. APCA and Alaska's health centers support HB 265 because it increases access to primary care and behavioral health services, and it expands telehealth in Alaska. This legislation does several things that are important to health centers. First, it includes a range of telehealth modalities, including audio only, both now and into the future. Second, it allows patients and providers to engage in telehealth services outside a clinic setting if they so choose. And then third, it provides adequate reimbursement for telehealth visits, providing new points of access to whole person care, including behavioral health and substance use disorder treatment. In 2020, health centers served 105,000 patients through nearly 500,000 visits. Telehealth and substance use disorder services are our fastest growing area of service. Of those, 40% were accommodated via telehealth. And in the subspecialty area of substance use disorder services, almost half were via telehealth. The temporary telehealth policy changes have benefited health centers because they have allowed health centers to be recognized as telehealth treating providers, to furnish some behavioral health services via audio-only technology, and to be paid for telehealth services furnished to Medicaid beneficiaries under the health center's bundled payment reimbursement model. Health centers serve hard-to-reach communities, and the majority of health center patients experience challenges in accessing health care that include long distances to reach local providers, cost of care, transportation, language, and cultural barriers. And in Alaska, over half of our patients are racial or ethnic minorities. A majority are low income, and most of our patients live in rural communities. Health centers can best serve their patient populations if they have the ability to use technology to meet their patients where they're at. Additionally, workforce shortages, especially behavioral health providers, impact health centers uniquely as nonprofit safety net providers. And telehealth allows health centers to use their clinical workforce most nimbly. In 2021, a cohort of health centers reported that of their telehealth interactions, 59% occurred by phone, 41% by audio or video. Through the pandemic, demand for telebehavioral health now represents 35% of all telehealth usage. Health centers have witnessed how telehealth has provided stronger continuity of care for patients, reduced travel costs, and has resulted in fewer dropped visits and less delayed and more costly care. We understand that delivering quality whole person care ultimately leads to better health outcomes, saves lives, and in the long run, it saves on cost. So on behalf of Alaska's Primary Care Association and health centers across the state, I urge you to support HB 265 and appreciate your time today.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Merriman. We appreciate you calling in and sharing your testimony today. There's a question from Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And just very quickly, I'm not sure if you've listened to the prior questioning, but I was curious if you could identify any situations where a first-time patient may require a prescription of a narcotic or opioid.
I don't have any information about that, but I'd be happy to get that for you in relation to community health centers.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Merriman. We appreciate it. And we will move to our final testifier, Tom Chard, the Executive Director of Alaska Behavioral Health Association. Mr. Chard, Richard. Welcome to House Finance. Please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Merrick. For the record, my name is Tom Chard. I'm the CEO of the Alaska Behavioral Health Association. ABHA is the network of mental health and drug and alcohol treatment providers throughout the state. We fully support HB 265 for many reasons, including some that I'll touch on briefly here today. Essentially, we're supportive of the bill because it improves Alaskans' access to behavioral health care. I wanted to tailor my comments today to a couple of the economic benefits of the bill. First, HB 265 allows Alaskans access to behavioral health treatment services and support without first having to see someone in person. We've already talked about that in committee today. The federal and state public health emergencies set aside regulatory restrictions that haven't kept pace with technology and have hampered access to care. The Department of Health and Social Services annual Medicaid report released this past November stated there was a 134% increase in telehealth claims paid in FY21 versus the previous year in FY20. The report noted that 4 out of the 5 top diagnosis codes for services delivered via telehealth were behavioral health diagnoses. This data point highlights problems Alaskans are having accessing behavioral health care when they need it, but it also points to the economic opportunity afforded by early intervention. Second, I wanted to provide a glimpse into how telehealth access saves money. The Trade Journal Behavioral Healthcare Executive pointed out in an article last month that national health plans like United, Aetna, and Humana are rushing to offer virtual first and digital first benefits. They're doing this because they understand it saves money by avoiding travel and other expenses, as well as avoiding the cost of relapse, readmission to the hospital, and higher acute care. In fact, Alaska's Department of Health and Social Services reported that Medicaid travel costs decreased $45 million from FY20 to FY21. We may be able to look at the immediate cost avoidance from reductions in things like travel, but that's not the whole picture. By offering early intervention and recovery support, we're providing savings to the overall budget, not to mention saving individuals and families from the heartache and hardship that comes with undiagnosed and untreated behavioral health problems. The economic benefits of the bill are just a small part of why ABHA supports HB 265. The Alaska Behavioral Health Association hopes you will continue to support this legislation as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chard. We appreciate your testimony today and always like to hear about ways to save money. So I see no questions from the committee, and we will go ahead and hold off on the fiscal notes until the next hearing on House Bill 265. So with that, Representative Sponholz, thank you for being here today, and thank you, Ms. Mina, for your presentation. And with that, we will take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. Our next bill is House Bill 296, Donations, Gifts for DOT and PF Signage. This is by Representative Rauscher. Welcome back, Representative. If you and your staff, Ryan McKee, could place yourselves on the record, you can begin your introduction. We also have Andy Mills, the legislative liaison, online, should there be questions. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Representative George Rauscher, State House, District 9. I want to thank co-chairs Merrick and Foster and the members of the Finance Committee for hearing this bill today. Part of the job of being a state senator or a state representative is to acknowledge those people, groups, organizations that have contributed to the community or the state or their country in a unique way that provides recognition. One of the ways we do that is to name a geographic location, structure, even an event or a bridge after those previously named entities through legislation. When doing so, one of the most common points of discussion is the cost to name that structure. I've never seen one voted on that doesn't have a fiscal note attached to it, and that alone has caused a few legislators to vote no on the legislation. HB 296 provides a mechanism for funding a commemorative name to a project by allowing receipt authority to the Department of Transportation so that the department can collect donations for signage. It does not require these costs to be paid by outside groups, but instead it helps codify a process that will not be reliant on state funds. At this time, Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce my Chief of Staff, Ryan McKee. He will, if you'll allow him, he'll go through a sectional, it's very short, and introduce the invited testimony.
Wonderful. Mr. McKee, thank you for being here. Please place yourself on the record.
All right. For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Representative George Rauscher. So going through the sectional analysis, Section 1, AS 37.05.146C, page 1, lines 5 through 7. This section adds gifts, donations, and grants received by DOT and PF to the definition of program receipts and non-general fund program receipts found in the Fiscal Procedures Act in accordance with Section 2 of this bill. And then Section 2, AS 44.42.060, page 1, lines 8 through 14, and page 2, lines 1 through 3. This section adds that the department may receive gifts, donations, and grants in accordance with a memorandum of understanding with the donor party. This section also outlines that the funds may not be used until the necessary funds have been collected from the donor. And then if there are any additional questions, Andy Mills is also on the line.
Are there questions from the committee? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I read the statement earlier, and I think I understand the bill. But there's a sequence of events. Does a bill have to pass to approve the sign before you can start collecting funds? Because if you start collecting funds before there's a sign approved, would that be kind of an impetus to say, hey, we got the money, let's do the sign? You know, does the approval for the sign have to come first?
I'm probably going to defer to Andy Mills, but I believe it doesn't. We'll have to Andy here, if you could chime in. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mills. If you would place, or Representative Rauscher, Mr. Mills, if you would place yourself on the record.
Yes, thank you, Chair Merrick. Andy Mills, legislative liaison for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And through the chair, Representative Wolf, the contemplation in this legislation is that a naming bill would move forward. Those are any bills that seek to name state infrastructure under AS 3540. And when that bill is introduced, it would include a provision pointing to this codifying language that says there's an intent for that naming to potentially be paid for with those donations. And from there, we would have that designated party or interested parties sign an MOU as outlined in this language. But it would take that naming legislation from a legislator to instigate a fiscal note, which this could then point to the statutorily designated program receipts as the source when those donations are collected.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you. A follow-up would be that I appreciate your answer because, I guess I want the dog wagging the tail and not the other way around, because if a group raises money for a sign and gets the funding, then they're sort of, influencing the whatever the bill might be, and that should be on its merits. And funding, I realize, has been a problem in the past, so I'm glad that there's a solution to the funding problem through donations, but I'm glad the bill has to come first.
Thank you, Representative Wolf. Further questions? Seeing none, we'll take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. And I see no further questions from the committee on House Bill 296. I will note that the committee does have the Senate version of this bill, which is identical. It's Senate Bill 168 by Senator Myers. And here going forward, we'll consider that bill. But we thank Representative Rauscher and Mr. McKee today for presenting, and we look forward to moving on with the Senate bill as well.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. And finally on our agenda today, we have House Bill 291, extending the Council on Domestic Violence by Representative Tarr. Welcome, Representative. If you would place yourself on the record and you can begin your introduction.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, who I think is probably online, and members of the committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to present House Bill 291. This bill would extend the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault through June 30th, 2028. The Council is due to sunset on June 30th of 2022, so we need to take this action this year to extend the Council so they can continue their very critical work in our state. When we have a sunset provision in statute, that will trigger an audit, and in your bill packet is the audit. We do have, as invited testimony, both Diane Casto and Brenda Stanfield. Diane is the Executive Director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and Brenda is the Executive Director on the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and they'll both be able to speak to the importance of the Council-Network relationship. But I do want to just highlight some of the report conclusions. On the very first page, you'll see that the audit concluded that the Council generally operated in the public's interest by funding and monitoring Alaskan domestic violence and sexual assault programs and prevention activities. So if folks aren't aware, the federal government provides a significant portion through the Violence Against Women Act and other funds to support the work of the network. The funds come to the state, and then the council administers them to all of the different shelter programs across the state, including some that are now, thankfully, getting into prevention work. If you look in the audit to the section where it has the findings and recommendations on page 13. And again, our invited testimony can speak to these in greater detail, but there are three recommendations in terms of their statutory responsibility to consult with the Department of Health and Social Services, that the council's executive director should implement written procedures to ensure public notices are posted timely, and the council's executive director should improve grant award and monitoring policies and procedures. They're all very, you know, they're very interested in meeting these recommendations as they do their work and continue. And then the second part of the bill that we added in the House State Affairs Committee adds a couple of additional positions to the council. Right now, there are the four public members, and then there are the five state members. And so what the additions would do is add a fifth public member, and this individual would be someone who is a member of an Alaska Native organization. This addition was at the recommendation of the council and the network because although there's a provision that requires a rural representative, that doesn't always turn out to be a person who is from the Alaska Native community. And as we know, there's a disproportionality with these issues in the Alaska Native community, and it's really important that we have that voice in this conversation. And sometimes the best way to ensure that those voices are going to be a part of the conversation is to make sure they have a designated seat at the table. So that's what we hope to accomplish there. There's also the recommendation that the governor would confer with the network and the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center, and so that would strengthen those recommendations and get someone who can really add to the important work. Then the idea here is that if you add a public member, then there would be another government agency representative added. And so you'll see on page 2, on line 10, number 7 there, the chief executive officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, or the designee of the chief executive officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, is added as a government representative. I apologize if we did not include it in your packet, but it came up in the House State Affairs Committee that, you know, was this in fact something that the Mental Health Trust Authority wanted to participate in? And so Mr. Williams, the executive director of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, did send an email confirming that they are interested in having a seat, that they would like to be a participant. And, you know, in reflection of what we know about trauma and mental health and substance misuse and the important work that they do, they were very interested. And I did just find the email. It says, given that trauma, mental health, and substance use, misuse, and other behavioral health issues can be present in situations related to domestic violence and sexual assault, the trust supports being added as a member of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. If added as a member of the council, the trust looks forward to being an active member and sharing its expertise with the other members and the public to address this very important issue. And with that, I guess I'm going to stop my comments and see if there are any questions. And then, of course, the very talented women behind me will be available to provide their invited testimony and answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Tarr. And I do not see that email in our packet, so if we forward that, we can get it distributed to the committee. Are there questions? I see none. Oh, Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just wanted to quickly thank the bill sponsor for bringing this forward. And I know that we were able to secure funding to offset the rising cost of utilities that many of these groups are focusing on and helping. And so I know without this passing that it would be kind of irrelevant funding. So hopefully we can get this legislation moved and passed into law. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And we do have Chris Curtis, our legislative auditor, with us today to go over the audit. Ms. Curtis? Thank you for being here.
Thank you. For the record, this is Chris Curtis, legislative auditor. I believe you have a copy of the audit in your meeting packets, dated July of 2021. So overall, we did find the council generally operated in the public's interest by funding and monitoring Alaskan domestic violence and sexual assault prevention activities and programs. The council served as a central coordinator for related services throughout the state, conducted meetings in accordance with their bylaws, and effectively met most of their statutory duties. They also concluded that the council should improve their document retention, access to the Batterers Intervention Program database, and the timeliness of their annual report and regulation updates. We are recommending the legislature extend the council 6 years, that is 2 years less than the 8-year maximum. We do have some information in the report on page 9. You'll find some financial information about their expenditures and revenues. You can see that their grant funding did increase pretty substantially during the audit period, and that is the result of increasing federal awards. Also want to highlight, beginning on page 25, you'll find a schedule of grant payments, and that's by CDVSA grant program, and then by grantee, and it also includes the location of those grantees, so you can see who's getting those funds in your locations. We do have 4 recommendations. They begin on page 14. We recommend the council's executive director allocate resources to ensure the annual report is submitted timely. That annual report is due to the governor and the legislature, and when we were conducting the audit in around May of 2021, it was about 5 months late. The delay was due to vacancies and competing priorities. Rec 2 is on page 14. We recommend the council's executive director improve training regarding document retention. We tested 11 files and found 3 were missing documentation. That should be an easy fix. Rec 3, page 15, we recommend the council's executive director work with the Department of Law to expedite regulatory updates. There was a regulatory project in progress at the time of our audit. Those were to update the domestic violence and sexual assault program standard regs and their grant regs. Draft changes include removing the ability for subgrantees to charge clients for emergency services provided, and this is important because there is a federal prohibition against charging clients for federally funded services. And according to the council management, those regulatory updates were ready to be submitted to the Department of Law back in FY19. They were asked to delay submitting those to the Department of Law to allow the new administration to organize. Then there was another delay in FY20 due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And then Rec 4 is on page 16. The executive director should continue to work with the Department of Public Safety and the Office of Information Technology to improve access to the BIP database, and BIP stands for the Batterers Intervention Program. The database is located within the Department of Public Safety, and it is subject to the criminal justice security standards. This means that new users must receive a background check. It requires fingerprinting. This fingerprinting and background check process make it cumbersome and time-consuming to approve access for new program users. Management's response to the audit begins on page 29. The commissioner and the CDVSA chair agree with the recommendations and support a six-year extension.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Curtis. Do we have questions regarding the audit? I see none. Thank you so much for being here today. And with that, we will move on to our invited testimony. First, we have Brenda Stanfill, the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Welcome, Ms. Stanfill. It's nice to have you back in House Finance. Please place yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you. For the record, Brenda Stanfill, I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Thank you very much for inviting me here today to testify in support of HB 291 and extending the council. We rely on them very much, and also adding two additional members to the council to make a well-rounded council that represents the voices of Alaskans. So oftentimes the network on domestic violence and the council on domestic violence, people get confused. Sometimes I get calls from people about the things I need to be doing, and I'm like, oh, I think you're looking for Diane. So I just thought I would just take a minute and tell you. So the network is made up of the membership of the direct service providers around the state of Alaska. These are all of the people that are on the ground doing the work each day. They come together in quarterly meetings to have discussions on how to do their work better, on supporting one another, on trends that we're seeing, and also to be a unified voice as we work to end violence. And of course, ending violence includes the work of oppression as it relates to the intersectionality of domestic violence and sexual assault. So while we're very different than the council, we do work right in tandem with the council to make sure that we're working on these issues throughout the state of Alaska in a unified way. There's never enough resources, and we really have to maximize what we do together. So both of us have the goal of ending domestic violence and sexual assault across the state, but we do have very distinctly different roles. As a network, we're there to support one another. We come together, we look at the issues, we provide support to victims. The council is the statewide organization that really makes sure that the funding is there, that the programs are being good stewards of their funding, and that the money is being spent in the way it's intended. This is both the federal and the state funds that come through. This includes victim services, the VIP programs, and also, very importantly, the community prevention efforts. We rely on them to hold meetings where the public can participate. So when they have their quarterly meetings, there's a section where they have public comment. This is a time where individuals can come forward and talk about what they see happening in their communities. They also commission studies where we have the latest information, such as the five-year victimization survey that is done. They ensure that the administration is informed of the work being done on the ground, the importance of the work, and they also are the ones that are advocating behind the scenes as those beginning year budgets come forward, make sure that the resources needed can be put into what needs to happen in Alaska to make sure that victims across our great state are supported. They also are the ones who conduct the planning meetings, and they also hold the strategic plan that will allow the state of Alaska to ultimately end domestic violence and sexual assault. and to ensure that the impact of these crimes on those harmed and those who did the harm are looked at through the lens of all departments in the criminal and social justice systems. Those are the people who make up the council. Those are your public members, and those are your members of the state administration. We have the Department of Law, Department of Public Safety, Department of Corrections, Department of Education, Department of Health and Social Services, along with four public members, one specifically designated as a rural. What you see before you adds those two new members, and that is something that the network very strongly supports being added. Behavioral health issues, I remember the very first quarterly report I did 25 years ago, we wrote in the quarterly report, it's really an interesting thing that's happening, but our shelters are filling up with individuals with substance abuse issues, and we don't really know what to do about it. 25 years later, we're still talking about that we're dealing with substance abuse issues and we're not sure what to do about it. The addition of the Mental Health Trust adds someone whose primary purpose is making sure that behavioral health issues, Alzheimer's, dementia, those type of things, brain injury, are being addressed in a way that is best for the individuals experiencing those. And that isn't always necessarily what we know to do without additional input. This will put that voice at the table. The other thing is Alaska Native individuals, they are overrepresented in the population of every shelter in all victimization. And not only that, but just in the social issues throughout Alaska. They're not always at the table to be able to say what it is that's needed. And in rural Alaska, we have heard through hearing after hearing this session about the disparity of public safety. This is also victim services. Many of our rural communities have no victim services right now. This would add their voice, and it would also add the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center, which is a relatively new organization that's been codified in the federal government that's very similar to like the coalition we're at with the network, but they work with our rural communities. They would be also putting forward a list to the governor to say who they feel like would be good for that seat. We feel like this would be a very good addition. And with that, I will stop my testimony because I know Diane has things that she would like to add.
Thank you, Ms. Stanfield. Questions? I see none. Thank you so much for testifying and for the good work that you do.
Thank you.
Next, we'll have Diane Casto, Executive Director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Welcome back to you as well. Please place yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
I feel like I'm at a news conference. Diane Casto, Executive Director, Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. So first of all, I'd like to say thank you to the committee for hearing this bill. Thank you to Representative Tarr for introducing this bill. And thank you to the Office of Legislative Auditors. They did a fabulous job. They came in, they worked hard. They put us to work hard collecting information. But I always like to say that personally, I always invite and appreciate audits and reviews of our programs because what that does is it makes us stronger and it makes us better. I've been at the council now for almost 5 years, 4 3/4. And in that time, we had in fiscal year 18, we had a full site visit from the Violence of Victims of Crime Act funding. It was a long and complete audit that looked at all of the ways we were doing our work, and there were 14 findings, which is a lot. And of course, I was brand new. I had been there 3 months. And so it was one of those opportunities where we sat down and were able to say, okay, why have we not been following all the right rules and regulations? So with that, we made major changes to everything we did. And I say this because I want to refer it back to a couple of the recommendations. So we, just as an example, one of the things we were not doing at the time is all federal funding, it is required to be given to grantees as reimbursement, not as advances. We were giving all of our funding out in advances. So that all changed. We had just an enormous number of changes, not huge changes, not anything earth-shattering, but critical things that just made our process work better. So we came up to speed on all of those, and it really improved how we do our work. It also put a tremendous strain on our funding agencies because they had to learn new forms, new processes, how things were done, how things should be done. So it was a long process, but it made us a better agency. In fiscal year, the early fiscal year 21, we had an audit of the office, DOJ office of the chief federal or financial officer. Again, we looked at our three federal grants from those programs. We had only one recommendation from that one. So clearly we had improved, but again, it was a thorough review of how we do our business. And then we had the sunset audit starting last summer. And so with that, we have, in my 4+ years, been through a lot of change. We have revamped much of what we do and how we do it, and all for the better, I think, I believe. So with that, I did want to just kind of start with an overview. And Brenda touched on this, but I will just build on it a little bit, and then I would like to talk about each of the four recommendations and the progress that we have already made on those. So CDBSA was created through legislation in 1981 to build a sustainable structure to fund and support community-based services to address the needs of victims, survivors, and others impacted by domestic and sexual violence. And I think this is really important because if you look through the audit and or you look through our statute, we have a lot of requirements, but ultimately it comes down to this. We were created to be able to accept federal money and to put that money out into the streets, out into our communities to do this work. So that really takes up a huge amount of our time and energy. As you know, we are housed within the Department of Public Safety. We have a 9-member board of directors, which Brenda touched on and Representative Tarr touched on. And we have 9 full-time staff. I will also point out that we had 9 full-time staff in fiscal year 13 when our budget was considerably less. So we are a busy office. We fund 35 community-based agencies serving Alaskans impacted by DBSA. And I always like to say we have programs from Utqiagvik down to Unalaska and every place in between. So we have a lot of programs. Within those 35 community-based agencies, we manage and monitor a total of 101 grant awards because we have, within those agencies, some of them have both a prevention grant and a victim service grant, or a victim service grant and a child advocacy center grant, or a prevention grant and a BIP grant. So 101 total grants, because another one of our findings back in fiscal year 18 was that we were commingling our grant awards, and when you have different funding sources, you have to have a separate grant award for each of those. So I just say that to put it into perspective how much actual work it is to monitor and manage these programs. But it's all good. So we do have 26 victim service programs. We have 18 enhanced service programs. That is programs we started in 2020. And it includes child advocacy centers. It includes legal services for individuals who are dealing with domestic and sexual violence. And it includes mental health services for youth who have either witnessed or experienced violence. Then we have 13 community prevention grants, and a total of 10 battering intervention programs that are approved by the state. 6 of those are funded and 4 are not funded. They are self-supporting. So that's who we are and what we do. I did want to point out, I wanted to talk just a little bit about the recommendations, and I won't go into a lot of detail, but we have made progress, so I want to boast about that a little bit. So the first recommendation was to allocate resources to ensure annual reports are submitted in accordance with the council bylaws. And the reality is, it's resources. When we talk about big resources, it's not money, it's people. And we've had a number of challenges these last 2 years, particularly 20 and 21. The 2020 was when COVID started, and 21, continuing COVID and a huge drop in our federal funding. In addition to that, we went for almost 18 months with 6 to 7 staff because of vacancies. During COVID, it was very difficult to hire new people. And then we also had one of our longtime staff on medical leave for a significant period of time. So, and we were without our administrative officer, our financial person for what we do is money, and we were without that person for a full year. I will say that as of Monday, April 4th, we will be fully staffed for the first time in 2 years. Woo-hoo. So we're very happy about that. I kind of hate to say it because the last time we were fully staffed, I said, let's have a group picture. And within a month, someone resigned.
Well, we've all had staff out recently, and we know who does the real work.
Exactly.
We appreciate that. Glad to hear that you will be fully staffed.
Yes. So with the annual report, it's certainly not that it's not important. We know how important it is. And, you know, one of the things that was said in state affairs and that's actually in the audit is that it's a lack of transparency, that we're not sharing this information. But I would like to say that one of the things we do and we are required to do by law is that we have 4 quarterly meetings. Each meeting is publicly noticed, and our full board packet with the executive director's report, the financial report, all the information, minutes from the last meeting, are posted every quarter on the state's online public notice site. So we certainly have this information out there. We're not trying to hide anything by not having an annual report on time. I will say that we have our annual report at the contractors right now being laid out and ready for printing. So we hope to have that done soon. And we will make it a priority now that we are fully staffed, and we'll make sure that we have next year's on time. This past 2 years has been a challenge. The next one is on training staff to help ensure document retention. And what I would like to say is, it's really not training staff, it's implementing, making sure that these new changes that we made, many, many changes, that we operationalize them better. You know, it has taken time to get everyone up to speed, to remember, oh yeah, we now do this instead of that. We've got new forms, we've got new policies and procedures. And so everyone has been trained, everyone is up to speed. And in the case of the ones that were found during the audit, we weren't quite there yet. We hadn't quite operationalized where everyone remembered exactly what had to happen. So I think we are clearly out of that forest, and everything will be well documented for our next audit. Now, where did my page go? There you go. Too many pages. There we go. 3. All right. Thank you, Representative. Then working with the Department of Law to expedite regulatory updates. As was pointed out, we have had many delays, not always at our delays. But during the audit, and I don't know if this was because it came up as an audit issue, but suddenly Department of Law appointed a specific regulatory lawyer for us to have at our disposal. So he has been working with us, Brad Sharp, and the regulations are just once the session is over, because we are also postponed until the session is done so that Department of Law can have actual time to do that. So as soon as session is over, we will be in the queue for getting our regulations out for public comment. So we are very excited about that. And something that I think Chris mentioned is that anything in our current regulations that is not in line with federal requirements, all of those federal requirements are now required as part of their grant awards. So all special conditions cover, for instance, the one about not charging clients. All of that is covered in our special conditions for the grant awards for those federal funds. So even though our regulations aren't up clear and up to speed, up to where they should be, all of the grantees that are receiving funds do have those requirements in special conditions of their grant awards. So we are very hopeful that the regulations will be out for public hearing very soon. And then the final one I would like to talk about a little bit because it's kind of a my pet project right now, and it's the battering intervention programs. I feel very strongly that this is a critical piece of our comprehensive services to end domestic and sexual violence. We have got to have strong prevention programs. We've got to have strong and available services for those who are victims. And we have to have services to address why people are being abusive, why is assaultive behavior acceptable, and what are the root causes. And if we don't have all three of those, we're really not going to make a lot of progress. We're just going to tread water. So I feel very strongly about that. And when I first came to CDVSA, I did a full review of all the programs. And one of the programs that I don't know if I'll use, well, it horrified me personally because we weren't managing it and monitoring the way we should have been. But there were reasons for that. We had very little funding. In fact, we get, if in our full grant budgets, our battering intervention programs get 1.8% of funding, 1.8%. And we get a lot of money. So they have very little funding. The person who had been in charge of these programs was, she resigned, and then the position got removed during, I think, 2016 when there were some budget cuts. So we didn't have anyone to do them. And we just weren't doing the work we should have been doing to keep on top of these approved programs. So I made it my mission that this was going to be something I was going to tackle. Well, now 4 years later, we're finally tackling it. We have started in April a work group to really look at these programs and determine what does the evidence and the research say about these programs, what are successful programs, how do we build good programs that will begin to impact and change that behavior. And with that, one of the things we're missing is data. And when I first got to CDVSA, I was told, well, there's a database, but we can't get to it. We can't get into it. And I said, well, that doesn't make any sense in my brain. And so I went through and talked with IT. Turns out there was a great database, excellent database with great information that was developed by a contractor many years ago. Nobody in our IT was around at that time. It's hard to get into. I don't know all the ins and outs, but to kind of make a long story short, we've been battling that. We've been trying to get beyond that. We got slowed down. We were making progress, but then with the centralization of our IT systems and OIT versus DPS IT, and it got slowed down again. But we are now working with OIT, the Office of Information Technology, and the DPS IT program, as well as the Alaska Microsoft team, and we're looking to move our database to a power-based platform where it'd be cloud-based, where our grantees can actually access it easily, get into it, enter their data. Right now, as was pointed out, they have to go through fingerprinting, they have to get approval to get into the system, they've got to have a password. And in nonprofit worlds, as you know, a lot of turnover. So it just became so egregious that a lot of our programs just started not submitting data or submitting reduced forms of data. So we hope to have a new system set up in the next maybe 6 months, and that it will be available and everyone will be required to enter data. And so we're very excited about that. And then with data, we will be able to make good and better decisions about what are the things we need to build into our new BIP approach. So with that, I will stop because I know I'm rambling on, but.
Well, thank you, Ms. Castro. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And just very quickly, is there anything in the database that would track, I know DPS probably doesn't track the victim side, but I'm curious on an offender, if we had stats on how many victims that they've had, because you may have an isolated case of one person and, you know, the recidivism rate may be better for somebody who's just done something like that once versus, you know, someone who has 10 or 20 or however many victims.
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, we don't actually collect that specific data, but we do have some data in the database that, that looks at did they have victims before, you know, and we also look at are they continuing to be engaged with the victim of the person who was the victim of the incident that got them into the program. So we are tracking things like that. You know, the issue about recidivism is really a tough one because we only know if they recidivate if they get caught again. And we also know that when they do get arrested, sometimes it's for an assault as opposed to a DV assault. You know, there's some, it's not always as clean as we would like it to be. And so one of the things we've talked about in looking at the data and what can be the outcomes is how do we track beyond just recidivism? Because recidivism can only tell us what's happening if they get reported to the police again or get reported back to a class. So there are other things we're trying to look at. We have an MSW practicum student that's been doing a lot of research for us with other states to find out how they're collecting data. And what we've actually found is that our database is one of the best ones around. It collects great data if we could have access to it. One of the things it does collect that I think is very important is it looks at some of their background, too. It looks at their ACEs, their adverse childhood experiences. Were they raised in a home where there was battering? Did they, you know, are those kind of things, were they themselves abused? Which I think really lays a good foundation for some of that root cause that we have been talking about looking into.
Representative Rasmussen.
I guess just a quick follow-up since you made the point about an upbringing. I think it's interesting that we've had a lot of conversation about kind of modernizing domestic violence, sexual assault, those type of policies, but I just saw a video on Facebook the other day of a little boy who's probably close to my son's age, I would guess like 5 to 7, and his mom was continuing to spray him with a bottle and he was soaked, he had water all down, and it showed him get to the point that he just completely shut down and just silently was crying. But we allow basically child abuse to happen on camera and there's no repercussions. So I think we need to have a broader discussion, especially when we talk about criminal justice and really looking at, you know, the childhood element of it and how we are classifying those type of scenarios so that we don't end up with somebody later on down the road who is then committing acts of domestic violence against a partner. So I appreciate you mentioning that. It's a good point.
And through the chair, if I could just make one comment. I agree with you totally about that, Representative Rasmussen. And I think what we know is that child abuse and domestic violence, they're interlinked, they're interconnected, and we know that so many children do experience abuse in the home, whether it's in partnership with domestic violence or a standalone, but violence is violence, and it impacts and it creates tremendous trauma in those children, and we need to be looking at both. And I actually started my career in child abuse and neglect prevention, so it's dear to me as well.
Thank you. And I would like to recognize Commissioner Cockrell from the Department of Public Safety is with us today. Thank you for being here, Commissioner. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, ladies, for presentation. Representative Tarr, thank you. Could you give me some examples of the data points that you're entering into your data bank? Are they allegations? Are they convictions? Are they arrests? Is it all the above? If you could give me some examples.
Through the chair, and I assume you're talking about the battery intervention database. So in that database, we do not collect all of the arrest data and those things. We do, we indicate that they have had arrests. We know what We know that they've been referred by the courts, in most cases, the courts or someone else. We get a lot of referrals also from OCS for individuals that are looking to regain visitation of their children or cut custody or partial custody, and they have to go through BIP programs to before they can do that. So the kind of things that we collect, we do collect, you know, related to their arrest, to the one that got them into the class itself. We collect, you know, some past information if they give it. We don't always have it. We can track that, but our programs, all the programs are in nonprofit organizations, so they're not, they don't have easy access to all the court records. They have some. So we try to collect as much as we can. I would actually, I'm happy I have electronic copies of all the data that's collected, if you'd like me to just send you a link to that. It's on our website. But it's pretty thorough, and it then does look at the victim as well. One of the things that is included as part of our programming is that victims have to be served in some way. They have to be protected. They have to be offered services. Obviously, it's voluntary for them to take them, but we want to make sure that one of the things we know is when an individual is going through a class like this or a program or treatment, that oftentimes they will become more aggressive because they're being challenged, they're unhappy. Victim safety is a key piece of BIP programming.
Representative LeBond.
And thank you for that answer, and thank you, Madam Chair. You presented to the Public Safety Subcommittee on this topic, and I appreciate that, you know, you and Brenda presenting, and thank you, Madam Chair, for bringing this topic forward to the subcommittee. And I know we have a fiscal note, and I see that Diane is the owner of the fiscal note, and I don't know if Madam Chair, you wanted to talk about the fiscal note, but I had a question that was related to the fiscal note, and should I save it or ask it?
We weren't planning on it, but if Ms. Casto is prepared to speak to it, we can go ahead and do that.
I left my fiscal note in my purse.
Sorry to catch you off guard, but I think it's...
Okay, here it is. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Fiscal notes everywhere.
Kelly. And perhaps if I can't answer it, Kelly can answer it for us.
Thank you.
It's always good to see Kelly in the room.
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. And the question is, I remember a year ago when we were going through the budget, the absence, or I should say the reduction in the Victims of Crime Act funding was a pretty big deal. And we had a lot of folks calling in. And we didn't have as many phone calls this budget cycle. So I'm looking at the fiscal note, and it looks like maybe, is it the SLRF funding that's backfilling that? And then I see the next fiscal year 2024, the SLRF funding, which may eventually finally run out, so we can't count on it. But you're showing an increase in federal receipts in the same amount. How does that happen, and are you confident with that increased federal funding?
Through the chair, no, I'm not confident. But here's what I will tell you, is that you're correct. Last year, we received a 34% reduction in our VOCA, Victims of Crime Act funding, from 20 to 21. So it was a significant amount of money, but it had also been dropping significantly, and I do have a number of charts on that, too, that I'd be happy to share with you. But it dropped from almost $8 million in 18, as was our award, to in 21, the award we got for last year was $2.8 million. That's a significant drop in funding. So, yes, last year the drop came quickly. We had been kind of told it's getting lower, we probably won't have as much, but we had no idea what was going to be dropped as quickly and as much as it was. So that's why the big kind of push last year was that we suddenly told grantees they were going to be facing a 30-34% reduction in their grant awards. And in one, you know, in 1 year, that's hard for nonprofits to be able to deal with. So we came back last year. You generously gave us $8 million in SLRF. We used I don't have my exact numbers with me, but about $5.4 million in for this current fiscal year for 22. We saved the other $2.6 million that will be used for next year. We currently, in the budget for 23, there is the 3.5 in the governor's budget that we are kind of building into our budget as well. And then we also have some additional, this gets a little complicated, but one of our federal grants through the Department of Health and Human Services, our Family Violence Prevention and Services grant, they gave us three ARPA grants from ARPA money that went directly to FIPSA. And so one of those, a couple of them were very specific what needed to happen. One of them was less specific, so we pulled $1 million from that, and we're going to spread that over the next 3 years as well. So what we have done for next year and 24, we're still a little short there, is we're piecing the budget together with one-time funding. With that said, another thing that we still don't have details about, but we have Senator Murkowski put in a $5 million one-time supplemental award for CDVSA. We anticipate we will probably get that in October, and we're hoping that we have that for 5 years, so again, we can spread it out over the next few years to make sure that we have adequate funding. But it is going to be a struggle, because one of the other things, you know, everyone said, oh, the VOCA Fix Act is going to be fixed. It's fixed. Well, it's not fixed. We were told last week that the Crime Victim Fund, which is what supports the VOCA funding, is at its lowest level ever. So with that said, we know that our VOCA funding is not going to probably pick up as quickly as we had been told or we hoped. So we are probably looking at another, you know, 23, we're good. I think 24, 25 is going to be difficult. And I believe this was... The funding here was put together before we actually had heard about the lack of VOCA funding moving forward. So we're still just kind of waiting to see where that goes.
Representative LeBond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One more follow-up on funding. There's also DGF listed on the fiscal note.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that $2 million, the money comes from what program, and is it predictable, and is it subject to the sweep? Do you know?
Through the chair, it is predictable and has been predictable. This was money that was given to CDVSA in fiscal year 18, the first year I was, or 17, the first year I was at CDVSA. No, it actually started in 18, and it was from Senate Bill 91, the crime bill, and so it has been steady. The money comes from the marijuana tax fund, and so far it's been steady. It hasn't gone down. I was a little worried when SB 91 was rescinded, and I kept saying, does that mean our money goes? But luckily it did not. So that was put forward, and that is specifically for prevention. Those dollars go to fund our 13 community-based prevention programs.
And evidently, as follow-up, Madam Chair, that money gets spent before it has a chance to be swept.
Through the chair, yes. We do not leave that on the table, on the table.
Good thinking. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just as a point for additional funding, do you know if any of the organizations that receive funding as a bypass or anything qualify with the nonprofit under organizations who are able to receive money from, like, poll tabs, for example, to any of the organizations?
I do not know that exactly for the programs that we offer. I know a number of programs do that. I back in the day when I was at nonprofit, we utilized pull tab money. So I think some still do, but I don't know. I don't know exactly how many. We certainly can find out. But I think, you know, one of the other things that has been a struggle, and I'm glad you brought this up, for our grantees is that normally they supplement their budgets with donations, with events, you know, events where they collect money. Well, during COVID, there haven't been volunteers. They haven't been able to have volunteers in the buildings. They haven't had the in-kind donations. They haven't had the as much donation because there's just not events happening and opportunities for that. So that has been another huge difficulty for most of our programs.
I guess just to quickly follow up, there is, I believe, legislation that would allow for expanded pull tab, so it would be helpful to know, I guess, if we have any organizations that benefit from that, because it looks like the electronic pull tabs invite new participants and could be to the tune of, I believe, 30 million maybe. I mean, it was a pretty sizable amount of money that we could have going as a non-government form of revenue, I guess. And anywhere we can expand in that, I'm open to work on that. Thank you, Chair.
We will get you a list.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Casso, for coming and testifying before the committee today. I know we are over just a little bit, but I did want to ask Representative Tarr. I saw in my notes that in state affairs that this bill received one do not pass. So I was curious what the opposition to it was.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Based on what happened during the committee discussion, I believe that Rep. Eastman voted no because he didn't support the addition of a member from an Alaska Native organization.
Great, thank you very much. Further questions or comments? Seeing none, thank you, Representative Tarr, for being with us today.
Thank
I know
you
you're
so
such
much.
A wonderful advocate for domestic violence and sexual assault survivors, so we really appreciate that.
Madam Co-Chair, may I correct myself about something I said?
Absolutely, Representative Tarr.
I apologize, but when I was reading the recommendations, I was reading from the wrong spot on the page, so if it was confusing, that was my mistake, and thank you, Ms. Curtis, for reading the right ones. I sincerely apologize. Thank you.
Thank you. And we can always count on Ms. Curtis for...
Just so you know, those were last year's record,
yes.
Or last sunset audit, and we did complete them all.
Great. Thank you so much, ladies, and that concludes our agenda for today. Tomorrow morning at 9, we will take public testimony on Senate Bill 9, which is alcohol beverage control. And I do want to note a few upcoming amendment deadlines. Tonight at 6 p.m. will be House Bill 60, the public school mental health education. So again, that's tonight at 6. House Bill 229, the Higher Education Investment Fund, will be tomorrow at 4 p.m. And then House Bill 272 and 273, which both have to do with increasing the BSA, will be on Saturday, April 2nd at 6 p.m. Also Saturday, April 2nd at 6 p.m. will be Senate Bill 9, again, the alcohol bill. And I'm going to set amendment deadlines for that same day for House Bill 265, healthcare services by telehealth, and House Bill 291, extending the council on domestic violence and sexual assault. So the two that we were introduced to today, again, Saturday at 6 p.m. And with that, I see nothing further before the committee. We appreciate your time today. We are adjourned at 3:41.